We've definitely got the right energy in the house this evening.
Everyone wants to see Marianne, so let's bring her on. Yes. And I almost feel like it's kind of strange to do like a whole intro, but we need to do.
No, I think it's very important, you know, again, as I was saying, you know, with Marianne's wonderful partner in crime, Wendy, this could not have come, I think, at a better time.
Yeah,
for many reasons.
Very thankful that we had this scheduled to be able to talk about the Israel.
Because the whole concept of politics of love, I think, is very important. Because right now, what we're seeing is politics of hate, violence.
Well,
no end in sight.
And greed.
And greed.
Unfettered greed.
Well, that's definitely a very big part of it, for sure. But having the right message that goes from being considered sort of a, you know, sort of like a fringe position is now becoming a much more commonplace position. You know, a lot of people are looking at Marianne's message as more of, we need a lot more of that in the political arena. And I agree. I think that there has to be this, you have to have a, politics is so vitriolic. And I think that's one of the things that turns most people off to it. They don't like being involved with this idea that you can't have a civil conversation anymore. If we are able to change that narrative with the right approach, which, as we have talked about many times, nonpartisan, non-corporate movement based on labor. And if you want to say a labor of love,
yes.
I think that would definitely
work. And it isn't just that. No, you bring Marianne on. But one of the things that I love most about Marianne is she is one of the few people that I've seen on a national platform who understands the nature and the importance of the collective.
Yes.
And that is the thing that, hi, how are you?
How are you? So nice to see you.
So good to see you. So I was just saying that one of the things I love most about you is that you really understand the nature of the collective. And this is something that I know we've talked about in regards to reparations, but there's certain things about healing the collective that we can only go forward when we do these things that sort of heal the collective. And when you start talking like that, so many people are like, collective is communist and all this stuff. And I'm like, no, it's everybody interconnected. And that's something that you always, I think, are such a good voice about, because nobody talks about that. Everybody just talks about policy, like in an acute way, this policy to fix this one thing and this, without looking at the big picture. So, but thank you so much for coming on our show.
Well, thank you. I've been on for about 20 minutes listening to you guys. You're so great. I was finding myself really interested in like Florida politics in ways that I would not have expected. It was really interesting. So really, Putnam was going to win. And then Trump. And by the way, Peter, your impression of Donald Trump is so good.
He has a few tricks up his sleeve. You'll get the whole package.
I just want everybody to know, don't listen to this lady. She's totally kooky. Listen to me. I know everything. This is my state. She's bringing love. She ain't bringing money. I'm all about money. And that's what makes the world go around. You can have your love. I'll have the money. It works better that way.
You even have the hand gesture.
He does it for all of his people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I feel like you have to have something that's different. And, you know, a lot of podcasts have their own little, you know, quirks and stuff like that. But
we're quirky.
We are. But that's what makes, I hope a lovely lady like this can appreciate something like that.
No, I did. I had a lot of fun listening to you. You're great. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
So let's talk. I mean, I know that when we originally were scheduled this, we weren't in this middle of the Israel-Palestine scenario that we're in now. And I have been having sort of even more so of a like come to Jesus moment about my feelings about this. And it's really hard. I grew up very Jewish, North Miami Beach. My grandparents were all very post-Holocaust fear-based. They were so fearful. They were so supportive of Israel. Like, we were just Zionists by birth. And I really second guess a lot more than I have lately. And so it's hard for me as a Jewish person because I get called a self-loathing Jew. But I'm just feeling like I don't think there needs to be nation states based on religion, and certainly not ones that cause the, you know, dispossession and trauma and violence and genocide to another group of people. So, how do you, because obviously you're aware of what's going on, how do you reconcile all this about Israel?
I appreciated that when I first got on, Peter was talking about how there's a big distinction between the people of Israel and Netanyahu. South Africa was apartheid, and then it wasn't, and there's still a South Africa. The United States has done some absolutely terrible things, but I still believe the United States has a right to exist. And the things that you just said about your reasons why you don't think it should exist based on religion, well, are you going to get rid of, you realize that's what Iran is, and you realize,
oh, yeah. Saudi Arabia,
and unless we're calling for the end of those, and if anybody were to say that they shouldn't exist because they're based on religion, we would be called Islamophobes for saying that. So I think that we all need to really step back a little, even the way you threw out the word genocide. I'll go with apartheid. I will. I think it's time. And I think as an American Jew, it's time. I'll go with some aspects of ethnic cleansing and ethno-state, but only ethno-state because of the ethno-nationalism that Netanyahu has brought in and with that 2019 bill. I'm not going to just, parrot a Hamas talking point and use the word genocide. I'm sorry. We've done terrible, terrible things in Iraq. We've done terrible things, but I just think we have to be extremely careful. And I do think it's time for us to own, just as the United States was founded, it couldn't have been founded without slavery. It is time for us to own terrible atrocities, the displacement of 750,000 people. But there was a democratic ideal, and there have been times in the history of Israel which are not like they are now. But yes, the status quo cannot continue. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And I agree with everything else that you guys were saying. I agree with the fact that Netanyahu planned this. The Judaizing of East Jerusalem is unacceptable. The settlements are unacceptable. The occupation is unacceptable. The apartheid conditions for Arabs inside Israel is unacceptable. And this needs to be, the United States has said for years that the settlements are illegal. We need to go beyond that. We need to condemn the settlements. So those changes are absolutely necessary. But if you go as far as some of the things that you said, Jim, then my question would be to you, so what are you saying? Because I hear a lot of my friends on the left who talk about how, based on all those talking points that we just mentioned, two-state solution, according to them, is no longer an option. I do not believe it's, do I believe it's on life support? Yes. Do I believe it's dead? Actually, no. Then they talk about a one-state solution. But when people on the left talk about a one-state solution, it reminds me of Paul Wolfowitz and the neocons talking about what Iraq was going to be like. Oh, and then there's just going to be this democracy, and it's going to be so nice, and they're going to be equal rights. And I'm like, you people are in fantasy land. Who's going to administer this? Because how do you think this is going to work, this one state solution that you think is going to be everybody's going to be equal? Because Hamas is going to come in, and Hezbollah is going to come in, and Iran is going to come in, and Iran's not going to go down, Israel's not going to go down without fighting. So we're talking there. We want to be very careful, I would think, and really think through what we're talking about, what we want to happen next. So what I would want to happen next is owning all the things, such as apartheid, such as the strong condemnation. It's time for the United States to change. There is no doubt about it. But jumping to all of the most negative things that we could possibly say about Israel, it's not just because I'm a Jew that I won't go there. It's because I'm a human being, and there's, everybody talks about how Michael Brooks said this was simple. I understand the part that is simple in terms of systemic oppression, but there are still parts that are very complicated. And the left should not become known for this simplistic conversation that we see so often on the right.
No, it's very complicated. And I don't have any sort of idea as to how it would even go about really being fixed. And that's what's so daunting about it, because the way that Israel has proceeded in the past however many years with the settlements and sort of this checkerboard approach to displacement of Palestinian communities, it's at this point, they've created a situation where the only way that you could fix that is now you've got to have all the people that are settlers leave and move out, or you've got to create new whole road infrastructures. I mean, they've really blocked them in such a way that it's really made anything going forward in any unification very difficult. Different highways, the checkpoints, that like it's very blatant.
But it must be done. That's the thing. Yes. There is no alternative at this point. It must be a multi-year process. Right now, we give the Israelis what, $3.8 billion a year. We give the Palestinians something like $300 million. Right. All of this must be changed. We must give money, and equally, we give money that is not to be used for military purposes. And everything that you're saying, when you have hundreds of thousands of settlers in these illegal settlements, yeah. and the world must come together, and the United States must lead this. We must have a political leadership in the United States that says enough. Enough. I don't want to hear Anthony Blinken or Joe Biden say that they stand for human rights and stand for that goal of what's going on in Israel. It will be difficult. It will take years because you've got hundreds of thousands of people in those settlements, but that is exactly what we have to work out, because the alternative is a level of violence that really could be the setting for World War III.
We're speaking with Marianne Williamson, a renowned author, former candidate for president of the United States. Marianne, if you can talk about, I think, an issue that's not being talked about enough right now, and it has to be addressed, because this is one of the reasons why resistance is so big to this on the Jewish side, is anti-Semitism is a very real issue. I've seen it up close and personal. I do have Jewish blood. I can tell you that it's, as I'm sure you know, it's a lot more subtle than it used to be, but it's still there, and I think it's going to rage very hard if we continue down this path. I'm curious as to what your experience has been like trying to identify that issue. And like I said, distinguishing the difference between Netanyahu's government versus the Israeli people. And the one thing I will say, there's a lot of great content creators out there. I'm not going to single out anybody specifically, but there's a lot of people in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem right now that are trying to create this narrative that all Jewish people want death to Arabs. And that is not true. That is an absolutely horrific way to frame this thing.
Yeah,
and you're only going to make it worse. So, and if anti-Semitism isn't a big enough problem already, it's now you're going to dial it up to an 11, that's not a good idea.
Right.
No. Global anti-Semitism is on the rise. And one of the problems I have with the American left, some people on the American left, and I certainly consider myself a leftist, is how there is now this narrative, oh, anytime we criticize Israel, you're saying we're anti-Semites. As though we're not allowed to say that someone is an anti-Semite. Now, if someone says you're a racist, you don't get to say, oh, you always say that. You're not allowed to do that. So why is it with anti-Semitism, we're not able to call it out at all? It's like, oh, you Jews, it really, that is anti-Semitic. Oh, you Jews always say that. And it is on the rise around the world, which actually, if anything, from a certain perspective, makes you think, well, the Jews do need a safe place. I don't see why it should be. You were talking about a theocracy. To me, I do not have a problem with the idea that the Jews should have a homeland and equally the Palestinians should have a homeland. I don't have a problem with saying that both should have a homeland. So I do believe that anti-Semitism is a problem. I believe that Netanyahu is making it much worse. The policies of Israel are making it much worse. These military strikes are making it much worse. But then at the same time, it being made much worse, bolsters the argument that the Jews need some safety. So I know [S2] Right. [S1] A lot of people scream and yell at that. Oh, Jews need some safety. My Jews need some safety. Yeah, but even look where that comes from and the sentences that go after that. It is subtle. My name is Marianne Williamson. So my mother is Kaplan. Her mother's maiden name was Deitzer. My father's father was Vishnevitsky, and they changed it to get into Ellis Island. So given the fact that my name is Marianne Williamson, I have throughout my life had people say things in my presence that they would not have said if they knew that I was Jewish.
Right.
Like you were saying.
I've had that. Yeah. I was a waitress at Outback Steakhouse in Indianapolis for a while. Mm-hmm. This was in the 93. It was in between school and grad school. And I was the first Jewish person that a lot of the people that worked back in the kitchen had ever met. I mean, probably a lot of people there. They were surprised that I did not have horns. Like, this was in 93. Yeah. I mean, Yeah.
And yet, like I said, with many people, you're not allowed to say it. You guys don't have problems. Yeah.
Right.
No, and that's actually a very good point, because I do believe if Bernie's last name was Epstein or something along those lines, it would have been a much different circumstance for him running for president.
Right, Sanders, or Schwartz.
Sanders is a very American neutral name. Yeah. So is Williamson. There isn't a way, you know, and someone says, well, they are, but
It could go either way.
If you know how simplistic so many people in our society are and how they only look at the banner headline, it's like if the last name was Schwartz, as Jen just said, that would have gone over a lot different, I think, with a lot of people. And even still, you know, the Clinton campaign tried to use that against him when he ran. I do think that that is still an issue that's an undercurrent within our society that doesn't get talked about. You know, so it is, I think it's very important that we, you know, you don't want to say, well, I don't want you to both sides the issue here, but there's no question that a lot of the tensions that have been built up for a very, very long time. And I do think that the best place we could start is with the land grabs. I think that's something that most people identify with. Like you said, it is apartheid.
I mean, look, that's a violation of international law. Yes. I mean, I think all of the things that are a violation of international law that the International Council has come down upon are things that we need to address. If everybody that is, you know, a democratic place says X and we're the only ones that are standing outside of that, I think we need to look at ourselves. I think we need to have a little self-examination there.
Absolutely. And American foreign policy has definitely been, but there's a sea change. You know, you had eight congresspeople, Democratic congresspeople last night calling for a ceasefire. You had dozens of Republicans, of bipartisan senators, Republicans as well as Democrats calling for a ceasefire in direct contradiction to Biden saying we support Israel's right to defend itself. Yeah. That's a big difference. And it's a difference not only in Israeli policy, but it's also a difference in that Congress has for so many decades basically surrendered its constitutionally mandated and granted role of a heavier voice in foreign policy. And I think that there will be more congresspeople, there will be more senators. You have someone like AOC calling it apartheid. Mm-hmm. So there is a change going on. And I think that that's the conversation we have to have. These strikes will be over at some point, but that doesn't mean that there will be peace.
Correct.
You know, yeah. Martin Luther King said that there is negative peace and positive peace. Negative peace is where there's no outright violence, but there's underlying tension and anxiety. And that positive peace can only be predicated on justice and brotherhood. There has been so much underlying tension, so much underlying anxiety because of systemic oppression, because of the illegality of the settlements, because of the treatment of the within the occupation, because of the treatment of Arab Israelis, and on and on and on. It exploded. It had to explode at some point. And if the Biden administration, and I can't believe that they don't understand this. I'm sure they do understand this. If they think it's as simple as stopping the strikes, because that will be just suppressing the symptom. And especially now, this symptom will just blow up harder. On the other hand, we have and I think there is an understanding of that. Now, what Jen Psaki was saying today was that the president feels that the best path is to do a lot of the conversations about this in private, so he's not telling us that much. We are being told that he has said that he wants to see a ceasefire, but that's short of making the kinds of demands that we need him to make. I mean, obviously he can't say with a phone call, I'm pulling the money, but he can make a lot of difference. And I think that that's where our conversation needs to be going. What are we going to do when this is over? What do we want the United States to stand for us, obviously, what do we want American Jewry? Now, I think one of the good things, and you've talked about it yourselves, I think American Jews are feeling more permission now to say, you know, this has got to stop. This has got to stop.
It's not okay. Yeah. It's just, yeah.
We're speaking with Marianne Williamson, renowned author and former candidate for president of the United States.
I wanted to ask, though, I mean, one of the issues that I think has been really affecting us regarding this is that now we have 30 states in this country that have anti-BDS legislation on their books. And this is something that, as somebody who is pretty much a free speech absolutist, you know, to me, this is just not acceptable at all. And it's been happening kind of undercover. Like, most people aren't really aware that this is going on until they go to sign some sort of contract with a county school board. And now they have to basically swear their allegiance that they won't support BDS. And this is a real problem. We don't do that for any other country. And I think that where Israel and the conflict over there starts impeding our free speech, And our Supreme Court has said money is speech. So if companies can spend an unlimited amount of money as speech, then we should be able to withhold our funds as a manner of speech. And so what are your thoughts on that? I mean, the BDS legislation.
Well, 30 states passing laws against the right of people to participate in BDS is like so many other areas where some of the darkest, most nefarious things that are happening on the state level. That's, we're all aware of that. We see that with voter suppression laws. We see it with anti-choice legislation and so forth. So this is a big, big deal. The idea of telling someone that they cannot participate in a boycott is outrageous. And would that feel to me, seems to me very unconstitutional. So absolutely. And I also think that after what's going on now, BDS will be picking up its steam.
Well, I think it needs to. It's, this is one of those things. It's really, I saw like this parallel between this and the Black Lives Matter. It's, you know, you don't want anybody to do violent protest. You don't want anybody to be doing things violently. But then when people do things nonviolently, you're wanting to impede that too, because really ultimately what BDS, whether I support it or don't, or whatever we can talk about, is a nonviolent movement for people to take a stand on something. And so whether or not you support it, its existence is, you know, should be acceptable. How else are people supposed to protest?
I agree with that more than I don't. And I have for myself supported BDS only in terms of the settlements and companies within the settlements. I think so much is changing right now. So I don't know how I will feel about that in 6 months. I don't know.
Yeah. I feel like I'm evolving on it too. And I,
yes,
one of my bigger concerns, one of my bigger concerns about BDS was that I don't know who's ultimately really being hurt, because a lot
that's
of boycotts,
the problem.
A lot of boycotts end up hurting small, medium-sized businesses.
And that Arabs work at.
Yes.
That Arabs work at. That's the argument that when I was in Israel and some of the things that were being said to me, including by Palestinians, you boycott that business. Yeah. And
so that's always been my concern. Like, unless I know exactly who's being affected by what I'm doing, then I'm hesitant. But if someone else wants to do that, that's their prerogative to do so.
We're speaking with Marianne Williamson.
I agree.
Former presidential candidate and renowned author. Very important. Now we swing it back in the other direction, because obviously we talked about the effects of anti-Semitism, but I think it's very important that we do discuss AIPAC. I think that they are, you know, they're definitely one of the most powerful lobbying groups in all of politics. And they, you know, the Zionist message is, in my opinion, as much of a reason for the anti-Semitism that exists as anything. And I do think that their stranglehold on both political parties, obviously more so the Republicans and Democrats, but it is still a very serious problem. And I do think that they are playing a significant role. They gave a lot of money to Biden's election campaign. A lot of people are dependent job-wise on what they provide. I do think that this is definitely one of the main sticking points. How do you feel about AIPAC and how we address that particular part of the equation that I think is a very big source of the problem?
Well, it's what Jim was saying before. Once the Supreme Court said money is free speech, all it is lobbying. So we have a lot, and they lobby for whatever the policies of Israel are at the time, and the policies of Israel right now happen to be very Trump-like and very right-wing. So the reason AIPAC is so right-wing is because the government of Israel is so right-wing right now. So as long as money coming from lobbying, you said that they gave a lot of money to Biden. I'm sure they gave a lot of money to Trump as well.
They're
very good at what they do in that sense of making sure that there is support of various kinds for the people who are running. But there are other Jewish voices now. There is J Street. Beth Selim is getting a lot of attention from a lot of Jews here as well. So there are a lot of Jewish voices of conscience.
Jewish voices of peace is one of the ones.
Also,
absolutely, there are many. And not only, so that's happening here in the United States, that's happening in Israel. But something that you were saying, Pete, just now, you said you think the Zionist message, I think the Zionist message is deeply deeply misunderstood. Because when you just said the Zionist message is causing the anti-Semitism, the way I hear so many people, what do you mean when you say the Zionist message? Because all the Zionist message theoretically means is the idea that the Jews should have a homeland.
I do think that people take it a step further. I think that there's, like in any case, there's always going to be it's sort of like the concept of any political identity. It, you know, on paper, it looks good, but then in execution, it ultimately ends up being not so good. And so when you take the issue of, let's say, Zionism, for example, I think that is akin to where it ultimately leads, in this case, apartheid, where they are doing land grabs and they're doing it by force. You know, the military might of Israel is, I mean, in terms of individual training, it's second to none. I mean, there's you can put an Israeli soldier individually up against any soldier in the world, and they would probably come out on top. And so when you're putting that particular issue on the table against the Palestinians who have been losing their
land. There's no doubt about it. All I'm saying is that there's a you yourself just conflated the two. And I don't think
I don't think he really understands Zionism. Zionism is the idea that Jewish people have a homeland. That's all
period.
It is.
That's all it is. Exactly.
It's not an ethno-state by definition.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, it's being executed currently as an ethno-state.
Because of the yes. political powers. What's happened in Israel, and you had said this earlier, Jim, before I came on, what's happening in Israel is what's happened in the United States.
Yes.
A small minority of crazy people have gotten political power.
It's all over the world. It's every. Yeah. The truth is, we're seeing it everywhere. Orban, we're seeing it in South America.
Absolutely. And you're seeing it in Hungary and in Poland. There's this rise of an authoritarian perspective. And there are many. It's tough. And also, in terms of what you were just talking about, the military, I'm not saying this is a good thing. But what's going to happen now that's going to be so difficult is, I believe, you know, when you look at what happened between Israel and Hamas in 2014. Rockets that could only go a little bit into the country now can go 50 miles in from Hamas. The Iron Dome is being very weakened by what's happening. I think to some people it's less effective than they had assumed. And so there's actually going to be, that's going to very definitely be used. All voices are going to be strengthened by this. Mm. This is the problem. All voices, the worst voices of everyone, are going to be strengthened by what is happening now. And that's why I think we need to be very careful, very compassionate, very centered in our thinking for everyone, and careful with our language, because we want to stand up for everyone.
I think that's a fantastic segue. One of the things that you clearly experienced when you ran for president is the power of the corporate media. I think it's one of the biggest hindrances for us to really build any type of sustainable movement. We see what they're doing on YouTube, for example, when they are crushing the algorithm now deliberately on behalf of mega corporations, whether it was you, whether it was Andrew Yang, whether it was even Tulsi Gabbard. There was, you know, obviously they did it to Bernie when he ran the first time, much more difficult to do it when he has the type of brand and name recognition the second time around. Nevertheless, anybody who has a nonpartisan, non-corporate message that they are trying to convey, and especially in a circumstance like this right now, as we're seeing, the power of the media, I still don't think people truly grasp how significant that is. Between MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, the reach is tremendous, and they pay a lot of money to have it out there. As you know, you travel a lot. Anytime you're in the airport, it's either CNN, most likely, or Fox News, depending on where you are. And they, what people may not know, is, you know, whether it's News Corp or Time Warner, they are paying these airports to play those channels when they're there. So siphoning through that message is very difficult. And I would love to hear your thoughts on what that experience has been like and what you've learned from that going to this point.
Well, it's a political media industrial complex, much as you said. And a lot of this derives from the Telecommunications Act in 1996, signed by Bill Clinton, which corporatized the media. You have the same kind of monopolistic power when it comes to our news organizations that you have in every other area, where a few companies, whether it's military industrial complex, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, and Boeing, whether it's a few food companies, whether it's a few chemical companies, whether it's a few big ag companies, whether it's a few pharmaceutical companies, whether it's a few health insurance companies, these corporate behemoths that form this matrix of corporate aristocracy or plutocracy. And our media companies are no different, but even at least as dangerous as all of the others, because it is monopolizing the flow of information. When I was a child, the same company was not allowed to own the newspaper and the radio. And the radio and the TV, because there was a protection of the diversification of information. Now, when that argument was made against the Telecommunications Act, interestingly enough, Colin Powell's son, Michael Powell, at the FCC said, oh no, the diversification will be protected because of the internet. And that's why the net neutrality issue is such a big deal. And everything that you were saying, they're even coming for you on the internet.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's why people like Greenwald and Taibbi and everybody's going nuts about that, that even on the internet. But even that brings up questions. Well, do you really want Donald Trump on Twitter? Isn't the world better without him? These are very serious issues, but I believe that we have to really make independent media we must protect, and we must do everything that we can to support each other, yourselves included. There is a huge progressive independent voice in America, but you know, it's almost, you could liken it a little bit when you were talking about the settlements and how the settlements have made such non-contiguous parts of the Palestinians, because it's like a little bit here, a little bit there, and everybody's separated from each other. And that's how Israel seeks to keep control. That's how the corporate power seeks to control us in America. We have these corners of progressivism and these corners of independent media and independent voices. And I think that we need to think more ourselves in terms of in terms of a resonant field, because when you actually look at where the American people, it's kind of like you were talking about Israel. Netanyahu does not represent the consciousness of the American people. I mean, of the Israeli people. The U.S. government is actually, in issue after issue, they have shown that the American people are actually left of center. The American people want Medicare for all. The American people are not, you know, when Martin Luther King said that the American people are far more compassionate than the U.S. government. So, yeah, what you're saying is true. The corporate media, we call them the mainstream media, and they are just a voice box for the corporate establishment. That's what CNN is. That's what MSNBC. You know, before I ran for president, I was very naive about that. I thought MSNBC were our guys. Now, some of the individual journalists are very lovely and ethical, but what I saw running for president, they are the operational tool for the politics of personal destruction, so that anyone the political establishment wants to get rid of, Anderson Cooper and et al., will make sure that the job gets done.
I think they also don't do it fast enough. You know, a lot of times people don't notice things changing until it's too late. That's why MSNBC of 10, 12 years ago, when you had Phil Donahue, when you had Ed Schultz, when you had Dylan Radigan, it was a completely
Keith Olbermann.
Yeah, well, before he went off the deep end. Yes, Keith Olbermann. And listen, Keith Olbermann's closing monologue about Hillary Clinton when she wouldn't drop out of the race in 2008 was one of the best things I've ever seen.
He was brilliant.
He was.
And Dylan, as you were saying, Dylan was so great on economics. Greedy Bastards is the name of his book.
But you can't have that kind of message right now. And I think the reason they can't is because they know they're losing control of the dialogue. I think that was that probably, as much as anything, I think is the greatest impact of, you know, what has happened over the past 5 years, you know, due to the shifting in the political narrative. Medicare for all is now part of the common vernacular. It never was, but now it is. And they can't put it back in the box. You know, thanks to Bernie, thanks to Andrew Yang, we now have UBI as a common talking point, knowing that a universal basic income is essentially Social Security for all. And there's a lot of different ways you can approach that. A lot of people love the idea of having a federal jobs guarantee, as expressed through the teachings of modern monetary theory. And of course, you know, we got to save our planet. I mean, this is out of sight, out of mind now with the type of things that we need to do. But the corporate state, and they use the corporate media as their you know, sort of their driver of the narrative to try to keep us, you know, down. But I just get
we don't have state TV, but we sort of do.
Oh, we certainly do.
We do. Well, that's what's so interesting. Like we've always sort of looked down on that. We've talked down on that, like what China or what the Soviet Union had was state media. And I'm thinking, yeah, so do we. It's just corporate sponsored. But it's still state media.
It's political media industrial complex. I saw that very clearly running.
Yeah.
And I do think that one of the things that we really should talk about is the importance of coalition building. I think it's something that doesn't get talked about enough. I think it's the only way that this is going to work in terms of long-term sustainability. Jen had her 50th birthday live stream the other day.
Happy birthday, Jen.
Thank you.
Yeah. And we had a who's who?
Oh, it was so cool.
Just people. I mean, Nina Turner obviously was the queen of them all who came on the live stream, and it was wonderful.
Well, because he surprised me. I didn't know he asked her to come. I would have told him to leave her alone. She's busy.
No, but Nina came on. We had Bo the Fifth Column. We had Vosh. We had Tim Black. We had
Steve Grumbine.
It was really
cool.
And it was just really great to recognize that so many people wanted to be there. And check your egos at the door. This is about a cause. We raised a nice amount of money for what is going to be these care packages we're doing as part of GenCore, which is our service organization here in South Florida. And it's to help people that desperately need it. And having that type of a reach in terms of that coalition build, I think is one of the most important things we can do going forward. And we see that happening through a non-corporate, non-partisan labor movement. You want to make it a labor of love? I'm cool with that too.
Oh yeah. And John, reminded me, Chelsea Manning.
Yes.
Chelsea Manning saying happy birthday to me. I was just like, that was the coolest thing ever, I think. I'm like, oh my God, that's Chelsea Manning. Like, that was really cool.
And I am curious as to your thoughts on coalition building and how important you see that being for
us. Well, crossing tribal lines. That's the thing.
That's what I said a few minutes ago, that we needed to work more together, that we're in this non-contiguous corners. That's my point. And I liken it to the Palestinians who are kept separate from each other because they all have to stay in one area. And that was my point. But also, I think in our country, when it comes to progressive independent voices, leftist voices, we have to take responsibility for that in the sense that so many leftists are into attacking other leftists. I mean, the cancel culture, I know my politics, that, you know, even though people these days will tell you what your politics are, I know what my politics are. But if I don't use the words the way somebody wants me to use the words, if I don't say the phrase they want me to say, then the most vile vitriol is thrown at me. And from people who, I agree with you. Why are you, you know? So a lot of it is ours to realize. And the other issue, not just coalition building, but electoralism. There's too much cynicism on the left about electoral politics. And I know you know this, Jen. When the reason we don't have policies that support working class people in this country is because there aren't enough working class people making the policies. But working class people so often don't even get to win the primary, because when Chuck Schumer calls to see if you should be the candidate, he wants to know whether or not you can self-fund. So I endorse a lot of candidates through somebody can find out more at candidatesummit.com.
Speaking of Elijah Manley out there, who is on and trying to get your attention, he's a big fan of yours, and he's one of our local. I don't know if you are familiar with Elijah Manley, but he is running for state house here. It's an open seat. He is one of our true like activist progressives down here in South Florida, and he is also the head of our Democratic Progressive Caucus in Broward.
And I think
maybe Wendy, if you could come here and get chat on for me.
Elijah
is one of the greatest hopes for progressive politics in South Florida.
Yeah.
Well, let me know. So I just feel that people, like, we did this thing called candidatesummit.com. Could you do this for me, Wendy? Are you coming in here? Thank you. Can you get me on chat? Hi, Wendy. Can you get me on?
Let me try.
Thank you. But, you know, somebody, over 50,000 people saw the candidate summit that we did. If every person who watched, even people watch till the end, had given $1, It would have been such a boost to these 14 candidates. And I don't know how you feel about that. I don't know. There's a disconnect for too many people. And then it's a catch-22 because they're so cynical about politics. But in a way, the Republicans are better at knowing you got to replace the people you don't like with the, thank you so much, Wendy, with the people that you do like.
My thoughts on it are always that we need to be doing inside and outside simultaneously.
Of course.
I am also very cynical and not so thrilled with electoral politics, but I do it because that's the menu, that's what's there, and that's the option. And so I'm living with it whether I participate in it or not. So I choose to participate to the level that I do. But I also think it's equally important to have our people on the outside doing what they're doing.
Well, that's democracy.
I'm all of it.
That goes without saying to me. Yes, of course, of course, of course. Our activism on the outside is what pushes people on the inside. But at the same time, you're going to have to get different people in there.
Yeah.
And one of the things that, I mean, that's really ultimately, you can't, you know, at some point, it's not just about pushing them. It's about get out of that chair and let me sit there. Let some of us sit there. And I just see these incredible people running. Incredible progressive voices who are running.
Yeah.
And it makes me sad to see how, you know, the people on the left side of the American political spectrum are big on showing up for the hot and sexy presidential campaigns.
Exactly.
But the Republicans, oddly enough, are more psychologically sophisticated about knowing every school board election matters, the state house election matters, the things you were talking about, that boycott, making a BDS boycott illegal. Well, that's on a state level.
Yeah.
A lot of people on the left couldn't be bothered to see who their state legislator is, to really see what's going on in their local and in their state politics, or even the midterms. Or even if they want to work on the midterms, they wait till the corporatist Democratic candidate is already chosen in the primary.
Right.
They need to get involved during
wait for their spoon-fed candidate to be handed to them, like packaged,
and then they complain. Well
you couldn't have said it better. And the thing that I've been trying to tell people is, if you're in the GOP, they value the committee precinct person probably more than anybody else.
You're right.
If you guys are not ready, and I would just use this as an example, there are no guarantees, but knock on wood, if you want to see somebody like Nina Turner run for president in 2028, then you need to start preparing right now for how you are going to build an infrastructure on the ground to make it possible. Why? Because Pete Buttigieg is already preparing to run for president again right now, and that's why he's in the position that he's in.
They don't
take these positions lightly. They take them because they think that's going to get them to the next level. Elise Stefanik is not the third ranking GOP member I think she's 37, 38 years old. She's not in that position because she's thinking that that's where she's going to stop. She's going to try to run for the U.S. Senate in the state of New York.
I'm sorry, but Pete Buttigieg is the Spice Girls of politics.
It is what it is. But that's what this is. For the majority of people, especially the corporate-minded people who get into politics, this is a career. This is what this is. You can hate it all you want, but unless you're willing to fight, like you said, where you need to fight, you have to get involved with things that are not sexy. It's very easy to rally for the presidency, but that was the biggest mistake that Bernie's movement made between 2016 and 2020. The infrastructure was not set in place the way it needed to be in order for him to make sure that the nonsense that went on in Iowa, especially, if they had an infrastructure in place within the Iowa Democratic Party, they would have never been able to get away with the nonsense that they got away with. And that is why the whole thing was, you know, sent into complete turmoil. They, as you can see, the one state that was smart enough to put these things in place was the state of Nevada. And that is why Bernie absolutely crushed in that state. And then, of course, the progressives took over the state party. I would use that as more or less what I would call a blueprint. That is the blueprint of more or less what you would want to follow. Whatever
to take control of your state party.
Yeah,
for us to take control. I mean, that's what has to happen, is that the progressives have to take control of their state parties.
Which is also why I think Amy Vilela, who is running again for Nevada's first congressional district, I think she's going to have an excellent chance to win now that an infrastructure in place within the Democratic Party that isn't going to work against her.
Exactly.
Forget even working for her.
I agree with you guys 100% on this.
Yeah.
I mean, you, what was that like for you? I mean, obviously, you know, what were your thoughts when you decided to run for president? I mean, obviously that's a massive, massive thing. It's a huge commitment, win or lose, whatever. I mean, how was your experience with that? Like, was it good?
Well, there were two distinctly different experiences, like two parallel universes. My experience of everything that you guys have been talking about was horrifying, and brutal, and personally brutal. Really, Tulsi and I were the, I mean, what they did to both of us. But voters were wonderful. And I'm sure you felt this when you run for Congress. I mean, I felt that the voters, you were mentioning Nevada, South Carolina, New Hampshire, Iowa. I think the American people have the dignity and the decency and the intelligence that is required. You know, Thomas Jefferson said the only safe repository for power in the United States is in the hands of the people. And I not only viscerally feel he's right based on my experience, but I also see the tragedy as the way the political establishment, which should be the conduit that facilitates the emergence of the democratic will of the people, more often than not, because they're under the same corporate control that the media is under and everything else, serves to thwart the will of the people, much like you were talking about with Iowa being a perfect example. So having been within the belly of that beast, I feel informed, you know, information informed. I've seen it up close, but I also saw up close how wonderful the voters, the American people are. I think that's really not just, you were talking before about the collective. This is not just something happening in American politics. This is the state of the world today. We have these economic and political systems that are literally threatening to destroy the world, whether it has to do with militarism, whether it has to do with environmental irresponsibility, whether it has to do with unsustainable levels of disparate distribution of opportunities for wealth. And then you have the will of the people of the world, which, so at the same time, you have the growing global specter of authoritarianism, you also have this growing explosion of democratic fervor. That's what's happening in Israel and in Palestine right now. You have the clamping down of the old, and you have the emergence of no, no more. And that's what's happening on the planet, and the race is on.
Yeah.
And I think that one world is clearly dying, falling apart, disintegrating, and in a devolutionary spiral. And one world is being born. And I think that our job as citizens of the world is to be tender midwives, to not only help the dying die tenderly, but to help that which is struggling to be born. Now, the world will change. The only question is how will we do so wisely? Will we change through wisdom, or will we change through catastrophe? Those are really our only two choices. And when you were talking about the collective, the same psychological principles that prevail within the journey of an individual prevail within the journey of a country. And whether it's the unprocessed trauma of the Jews or the unprocessed trauma of the Palestinians, whether it's the unprocessed trauma of various aspects of the American past, our need to atone for slavery, our need to pay reparations, yeah. All of this, we are now in the 21st century, and we are, the wisdom requires that we be far less mechanistic in our perspective, that we go deeper, that we don't just treat symptoms, we address these deeper causes. And until we do, there will be these terrible problems. And when we do, we will begin to turn the corner.
Speaking with Marianne Williamson, renowned author and former candidate for president of the United States. You know, one of the things that you just mentioned, which I think is very important, is this idea of being able to let go. You know, I really don't, we really try not to talk about our congressional representative, but I think Wasserman Schultz is a prime example of somebody who you're literally going to have to drag her out by her cold, dead hands, because that's the only way she's going to leave politics. And I think that that's true.
She's very toxic in my ether.
Yes. Marianne would definitely agree with that. But I think that she's emblematic of a very big problem in politics. You see it on both sides where, and especially this, it's much more so, I think, on the Democratic side right now, because there's much more of an uprising of non-corporate change within the Democratic Party that is attempting to take over. And a lot of these old guard individuals are not going to walk away voluntarily. Hell, Charlie Crist is running for governor again in the state of
Florida. Not go voluntarily. Alcee died in his seat with stage 4 pancreatic cancer and yet ran with it last time. So yeah, nobody's going voluntarily.
And so I'm curious as to how you see this evolving. Do you really think that people are just going to, arbitrarily step away?
They pick their successors. That group has already chosen Pete. They've already chosen Amy. They've already chosen, Pelosi will leave, and they've already chosen Hakeem Jeffries. They have their corporatist replacements. They got rid of Perez, and Harrison is somewhat better, but he's still that corporatist mold. So they plan their successors. They plan their succession. Yeah. And like you said, they plan them years in advance.
Yes. I don't know if she has picked her successor, if that's going to happen. I have somebody in mind that we know that's in the state house right now. That's a good friend of hers. That probably would be that person.
No, but I don't know. Our representatives tend to choose their successors.
Yeah, but I personally think, and this is just my opinion, Debbie is a career politician in the truest sense. She's never had a job outside of politics. She literally went into the state house at the age of 22, I believe. So this is somebody who has always been there. And I truly believe, because she's been in politics, elected in Broward County for 30 years. I think she'll go another 30. I don't think there's any reason, unless she, literally gets voted out, I don't really see her leaving. And I think that's true for a lot of other people. I think and that also leads to the issue of gerrymandering, which is a very serious problem, and we're dealing with it again because we're not going to know what our districts look like at least until sometime next year. So I do think that there's a lot of infrastructural problems that are still in our way, but that's why, like you said, being more involved in the not so sexy areas is really the key to getting a lot of these, a lot of the people that are sitting there because they have this infrastructure in place that's so entrenched. It's not one person you're dealing with. You're dealing with the school board. You're dealing with the unions. You're dealing with the old guard people that are in the Democratic establishment that like things the way that they are, even if it's to the damning to the people that need a change. Their attitude is, it's the way we want it, and that's it. People be damned, so to speak. But I do think that that is more or less how it's going to happen. Like you said, I think changing that infrastructure at the ground level is very important, and recognizing the value of being involved, even though it's not as easy for a lot of people. I think we try to set as good an example as we can. And the more people are involved, I think the more likely it will become where it's not like a, 2-3% chance that an incumbent is going to get knocked off. Maybe it becomes a 7 or 8 or even 10% chance that it happens. Once you start moving the needle that far, it's really going to, it's what's ultimately going to define us. And now we do have a question from Jean Carla Rodriguez. Marianne, would you ever run for Congress again? And how was your experience running for Congress the first time?
Yeah, I don't think people realize that you did run before you ran for president. Yeah.
Well, like you, Jen, I don't know about you. When I ran for office, I got a gut punch. And if I ever get a gut punch, I'll let you know. Right now, I don't have that gut punch. I'm certainly not running anything. I think if I was running for anything in 2022, I'd know it by now. There has been no gut punch. Right. I don't know.
Have you been working on? So what are you,
I'm working a lot. I will be starting a Substack page soon. I've been working on it with a podcast. I'm doing a lot of, we were talking about, Israel and Palestine. I'm doing a lot of interviews that I'll be putting up. I will be writing another book, that will come out next year, and I teach classes. So I'm very busy. I write for Newsweek a couple of times a month, and, I'm doing the same thing you guys are doing and that so many people we know are doing. I'm just trying to contribute to the conversation as best I can. And I think that that's really what you were talking about before on coalitions. It's It's almost like an invisible field of coalition building, that you know that we share the same molecules. I look at you, Jen. I know that I had endorsed you for Congress. I know you're out there. You know I'm out there. I see your tweets. You see mine. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I think we're all just, you know, it's not a time of soloists. It's a time of a choir. And I think there is a choir. But I do think we need to be more hip to each other when we're running for office. I think we need to be more supportive of each other. I think when you, and not just wait and see who's running, but really get started early. That's why I hope people, like I said, will go to candidatesummit.com. Every other night on my Twitter page, I put the little 4-minute segment that these candidates did, and some of them are so moving. There yeah, are people, wonderful people running. Get behind them now. And, you know, obviously, you know, we're not, these are not the corporate backed candidates. Nobody's expecting you to, you know, send $2,800, send $5.
Yeah.
You know, I see that so often. I see, you know, I'll look and I'll see, well, 9,000 people watch his video. And I'll think, well, if all of them gave $1.
Yeah.
So I think we have to, you know, look at how the Republicans, you know, got rid of Eric Cantor when Eric Cantor had millions of dollars. It kills me when I see people on the right have more rambunctiousness sometimes.
Right. How did that happen to us? Where did we go? You know,
well, we just went into, we got stuck in the anger. You know, it's like the chakra system. We got stuck at anger too often, and we spew the anger. We need to transition from the anger into political activism, so that we can be more effective. Wouldn't you
one thing?
So?
Wait, I want to say, like, when you were just talking about like we're sharing the same sort of space, but a lot of what I feel like I've been doing over the past 2 years is like weaving this web. And I see it as a web. And every time, for example, you coming on here, that's one more link in this web.
Exactly.
Because
it's
one more connection. And so one of your people then sees us and vice
absolutely
versa. And this is what's building it and making it stronger. And so every time we do like a cross stream with somebody or anything, it just keeps reinforcing it. So I feel like that's a big part of what we're trying to do. And with voices that are not necessarily always going to be in sync. I'll talk to anybody.
I think that what you just said is really important. There are too many people in America, including on the left, who think everybody has to agree with everybody all
with
the time.
With everything.
No.
What the hell's going on? It used to be, oh, that's interesting. You think that? I don't see it quite that way. I see it somewhat differently.
Yeah.
And but like anybody, nobody has a monopoly on truth. But these days, even on the left, it's like you're wrong. You're not just it's not just that I disagree with you. It's that you're wrong. You're bad, and you should shut up.
Yeah.
And you should delete that tweet. I don't agree with your tweet, so you should delete it. No, I'm not going to delete it because you don't like it. It's unbelievable, actually.
Yeah.
It's
so really
bad for democracy.
We cross over all sorts of lines. I mean, I will go on any show. I will have any guest if I believe that that conversation and that dialogue will further the progress that we're trying to make. Like if I feel like there will be a positive contribution, I'll talk to anybody. I don't need them to be on my same team to have a conversation with them.
Well,
that's fine.
That's what only in a totalitarian society is everybody supposed to agree all the time. I mean, that's what freedom is about. And there are high-minded conservative principles and there are high-minded liberal principles. Meanwhile, the real authoritarians love the fact that we're so divided among ourselves. Because as long as we're so divided among ourselves, we can't put together the political force. Like when I heard you guys talking about Florida, that there are more Democrats than Republicans. I was really interested listening to you.
And yet
guys.
We're red. We are red.
And we're dead red. I mean, this is a state.
We are. We're not a swing state. I don't know why people ever really thought of us
no,
that way.
No, I would say this.
Really,
if Ron DeSantis is reelected as governor and is the Republican nominee in 2024, Florida will not be a swing state. It will be a red state. It will go red and the Republicans will have every opportunity. And this is why it's so significant to stop DeSantis, if it's even possible, is because if Florida is not a swing state in 2024, that means Georgia's going to be in play because they're going to send everybody into Georgia to try to flip it back. And that probably would break the election because it's only going to take, for anybody who doesn't know this, the margin is so thin that it would basically just, it would take Georgia and Pennsylvania to swing back. And they wouldn't even have to chase Arizona at this point. That's why the Electoral College, in many ways, I do support it. It needs to be modified, but it definitely, it allows much more of the, of valuing the states that I don't think is necessarily there. Granted, a lot of them are just kind of throwaways, but nevertheless, I think that having an infrastructure at the ground level, as we talked about, is so vital. But another thing, you know, the last thing that I do want to talk about is, I don't think people to this point still have wrapped their heads around the fact that Trump was our president and how it happened. I think they still want to sweep it under the rug like it didn't happen. I don't think people realize just how angry and desperate so many people in this country are right now, and how it is getting to a boiling point. And you can only ignore it for so long before Trump was, listen, I'm sure you've met him. I've met him once myself.
No, I've never met him.
I met him. You know, look, he's very grandiose. He's very much P.T. Barnum.
He's disgusting.
He is.
He's absolutely disgusting. He's a caricature of himself.
He's not as smart as he thinks he is. But
really?
Yes, that's true. He totally thinks
he's smart. Yeah, he's a rocket scientist.
But what you're going to end up having.
Remember when he said he was smarter than all the generals?
I totally know more than the generals know. Totally more than that. And the truth is, he may not be the brain of what is necessary, but if Biden's administration, if what is happening right now, if we do not see any type of fundamental change, whether it is with a living wage, whether it is with any type of economic program, an infrastructure bill, having a federal jobs guarantee, UBI, even reoccurring checks to backdate all the money that people have lost in the pandemic. I mean, the possibility of an eviction moratorium is so serious that it again is not being talked about. What you're going to get in 2024 is an even worse Trump, because you're going to get somebody who's fully competent. If somebody like Ron DeSantis becomes president of the United States.
Oh, I'm way more worried about Rick Scott than Ron DeSantis.
Rick Scott can't sell himself on the national stage, DeSantis can. And that to me is a very, very serious thing. And Ron DeSantis has zero F's to give. He really does. And that is the thing that I still think people underestimate when it comes to, especially independent voters. They like a person who doesn't give a damn, who is just going to do what they're say what they're going to do and do what they say. And that to me is still, especially on the left, is really underestimated. They really don't understand that unless we have serious infrastructural change, it's only going to get worse. And that's why people on the left have to stop with this whole, if you're not perfectly aligned with where I stand, this is not going to work.
It just weakens us. That's
all you can't. And I think that's one of the best ways to wrap. If you can talk about that, how the evolution of Trump is still being underestimated, how it could potentially get even worse, and why it really is of such importance to coalesce right now.
Well, the first thing I want to say is that I agree with you 100%. I think that the economic rage and despair of millions and millions of people is what elected Trump to begin with. There were only two people in 2016 who validated people's pain, who validated their rage, even saw their rage, and said, yes, you're getting screwed by the system, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. And that populist cry of despair was going to make itself heard, either through an authoritarian populist or through a progressive populist. And as we know, the Democratic Party suppressed the progressive populist. And I think that Hillary's message of let's just continue the success that we've had for the last 8 years fell as such an insult to so many people. Not that she didn't care about their pain, I think she did, but her message was so off tune with millions of people saying, what are you talking about, lady? I'm drowning here. And I think you're right, Peter, they're drowning now. And I think that if the Democrats really wanted to hold the House and the Senate and increase their hold in the House and Senate in 2022, they would have given $2,000 a month checks until the pandemic was over and retroactively, easy, done, we won. And the reason I say the $2,000 checks even more than the various things that you just mentioned is because of the visceral impact it has on people in their lives every single day. This incremental approach, what Biden is doing and some of what he's doing is good. But even with what he's doing that's good, even where it's good, my fear is that it's too little, too slow, and too late. and it has no impact on people's lives in a way that will make them not just search for something that might be different in 2022. I agree with you. That's really all I can say is I agree with you. And I think that so many of us, like both of you, who are yelling, you've got to change this. You've got to just end the filibuster. You've got to give the $15 an hour minimum wage. You've got to give these stimulus checks. But when they would sit there, should it be $1,200, should it be $2,000? Give the fucking $2,000 and give it now. Do you realize what people are going through? And now, and we're saying that with such upset for two reasons. Number one, because people are hurting. But number two, because this is the way to lose in 2022.
Yeah.
And if you lose in 2022, for all the reasons that you guys have been talking about with Florida, et cetera, we're going to have such a hard time in 24.
Yes.
And also, as you guys have been talking about so well all throughout this program, what we could have in 24 is another Trump, but an even smarter one.
Oh,
and
I,
then our democracy is...
Yeah.
I'm only looking at two things in 2022. If the Democrats lose the House and the Senate, and if Ron DeSantis is reelected, he is the next president of the United States. I'm calling it.
Oh, God.
So I know people don't want to
hear. Get all prophetic.
Well,
like that.
Hey, listen. You know what? I did say Trump was going to win long before a lot of other people thought he would.
Marianne,
so
thank you.
It's been nothing but a pleasure. Cannot say enough great things about you, and you know.
I feel the same about you. I knew Jim was great, but I didn't know you till tonight.
This has been my behind the scenes partner from the get-go. This we started our campaign together. We like it was a discussion as to it was basically his idea. He started piecing together my demographics and being like, "Oh, you might be formidable," you know. Like so, this has always been a joint venture. Like we've always been.
So let me ask you. So how often is your podcast on?
Mondays and Thursday nights. We occasionally will do a special spot depending on his person's schedule. But Mondays
well, yeah, like
Thursdays.
Certain people, if you can't come on at that time, we'll interview people whenever. Yeah, we'll do stuff.
So let me ask you this. Are you guys going to, you asked me if I would run again. Are you going to run again? What are you guys going to do?
There's a couple of variables we'll look at.
Sure.
I think that we're building a solid foundation right here. I think that there is a distinct possibility that if Jen does run again, that we might actually take off this election cycle and wait till 24. I think a lot of people are also mentally exhausted about a lot of things that have gone on over the past few years. And I also think that if we're going to run against Debbie again, we are only going to do it if we really have a pathway.
We've learned a lot. It was a great experience. We built a coalition. We're still working that platform. We're using it. I still look at it as part of movement forward, regardless, win or lose. Our campaign was a service campaign. Like that was always what we were about. So for me, it's been a great experience in that and building it forward. And I feel like right now we would need to know certain things are in line, both financially and what we talk about this a lot, but labor is a big issue here. And the stronghold that Debbie has on our local labor force is challenging.
And it's not
and so
even
we
that,
would need to, I mean, yeah. There's a few things that would need to fall into place for it to be strategically worthwhile.
I think it was definitely worth the experience. We got almost 30% of the vote with all things working against us. I mean, we didn't even get a chance to really dive into that. We should definitely do a podcast again at some point. And we'll talk about those things at a later date. But all things considered, I think we did a very solid job considering we really didn't know, you know, Adam from Eve in a lot of ways in terms of how to do it.
We were kind of just flying by
when I say hands. When I say that Debbie is the, you know, the queen of Broward politics. If you're coming for the queen, you better not miss, because a lot of people want her out, but they will not say
they won't stand up
and they will not challenge her.
So it's just we just need to get, we need to know that all the, if when I know that all the ducks are in a row, I'll know that it's the right thing to do.
I will say this.
I understand.
If Nina Turner wins her election, that is going to help significantly. If
I know a lot of
people don't want to hear this one. We obviously, you know, obviously Diane Morales would help. But you know what? If Andrew Yang becomes the mayor of New York City, that is going to help Jen. So there are just, you know, certain things obviously need to fall into place.
But really, most importantly, money and labor.
Money and labor. And again, the last thing I'll say about labor, this is very important. And Marianne, you know this as well as anybody. what I tell everyone when it comes to labor, it's very simple. The rank and file versus the board are two completely different animals. When Bernie ran for president against Hillary, every time the rank and file was allowed to vote, Bernie won the won the endorsement every time. When the board made the decision arbitrarily, Randy Weingarten of the teachers union, that is when the establishment ultimately gets the call. And that is the same thing here. I single out Randy Weingarten because she is somebody in particular who decided to endorse Debbie without even allowing us to go through an endorsement process, which is against the charter.
I saw so much of that.
It's rampant.
They don't even let you have and the women's groups were sometimes the worst, I found.
The only one that is good.
Won't even let me have an interview, huh, guy?
There is a feminist too.
For the feminists, that's so feminist of them.
Well, I would say the women's group that is actually really good and still has some degree of that grassroots element to them is the League of Women Voters. But when you deal with an organization, well, I'm going to say it. You don't like it. That's okay. You could call me a misogynist, sexist, all you want. But Emily's List is a great example of a group that does not have women's issues at their heart.
No, that is not what they are there for.
Again, you don't want to hear it, but Planned Parenthood is one of the biggest impediments to Medicare for All. Why? Because they are a lobbying organization like any other. They make a lot of money. That doesn't mean they don't do good things for women, but they do not want universal health care because if we had it, they would have no reason to exist.
Yeah, Planned Parenthood. I used to be a volunteer for them for years. Yes. Like, obviously, I mean, I'm supportive of the concept, but yeah, they adamantly work against single payer healthcare.
Well, I did not realize I had not thought about that.
I didn't either. And it's unfortunate because I hate to not speak positively of Planned Parenthood, but just like some people are on your team with some things and not on your team with other things, that is one of those clear examples.
Once you have a full understanding about how all this works and you can pick off the things that you know are coming your way, they're kind of running out of ways to distract us, so to speak.
Yeah.
It's like right now they're focusing on Marjorie Taylor Greene. It's like there's nothing to focus on there. She's a Yahoo. She wants attention. Don't give it to her. And of course, the media is going to do it because it's going to gin up ratings. But it's like the Democrats who think that they're going to run in a plus 27 R district. It's not going to work. Yeah. You are either going to get a non-corporate GOP candidate to run against her, or you're just going to have to deal with her because that's how this game is. Until you fix a lot of these infrastructural problems,
we need to be strategic. That's the biggest thing is you can't just say, I want that seat. It has to be strategic.
Correct.
Things have to fall. Well, you know.
Yeah. If you want to get, you know, it's like, you're from Texas. If you want to get Ted Cruz out of the U.S. Senate, you need to build it doesn't matter how much people hate Ted Cruz. It's all about whether you build the infrastructure that needs to be in place.
Well, no, hold on. I think that there are two kinds of campaigns. For one kind of campaign, absolutely what you're saying is true. But there's another kind of campaign where the point is that you probably will not get elected, but that you're saying something that needs to be said. And there's a value to that kind of campaign as well. So for the some of the things that I talked about in the presidential campaign, no, they were not going to let somebody coming out against the military industrial complex, talking about big pharmaceutical companies, food companies, chemical companies, reparations, environmental injustice, children, and Department of Peace. But the conversation was important and very much received by the voters, which is why the media makes sure that it was blocked as much as possible. So I think there's value there too.
I think it's incredible.
You know, because at this point, when I think of whether or not I would run again for anything, the value to me is in the campaigning. The value is in the giving people, you can't control where the system is going, but you can control whether or not the American people have the option of a certain kind of message.
Exactly.
Marianne, one last thing before you go, and this is my fault for not remembering to bring it up. But as I mentioned before, you know, our local organization is called GenCor. It is a nonpartisan, non-corporate movement based on service to our community. And one of the things that we are really adamant about doing is building community gardens. I think that this is something that really needs to be duplicated all over the United States.
I agree.
I think it's going to be, what, what, you know, we talk about the three biggest conglomerates that run our country, big pharma, big oil, and of course, big agriculture. And going after big ag, I think, is very doable if people learn about self-sustainability and building these community gardens, yeah. Whether it's allowing people very cheaply being able to eat healthy fruits and vegetables, composting, which is it's so underrated. And then, of course, being able, depending on the size of the community garden, being able to have bee colonies and being able to do the types of things that we really need to do.
You're sounding very hippie.
I'm not a hippie.
You're very hippy dippy to me. Just I'm rubbing off on you.
Yeah, right. I'm just saying that these things are essential. And I think having, you know, somebody like yourself, you know, helping cross-pollinate with us could really go a long way.
Because, I mean, that was a large part of my campaign, actually.
Yeah.
Food and big ag and big food companies, chemical companies, the toxicity of our food, the toxicity in our water. I've had people like Mark Hyman on my podcast. So I'm with you entirely. I'm signed on for everything that you guys are talking about.
Well, we certainly hope to connect with you again.
Thank you so much, Marianne. I appreciate your time so much.
Oh, I think you guys are great. Thank you.
What you're doing. And when your new book comes out, maybe you'll come back and talk about it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. All my best, guys. Bye.
Love you. Thanks, Marianne. Have a great evening.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.